Hi, this is Eric Greb, Senior Associate Editor of Neurology Reviews. With me is Dr. Kimford Metter, Director of the Emory Epilepsy Center and Professor of Neurology at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. We're going to be talking about a study of fetal exposure to various anti-epileptic drugs that Dr. Metter presented at the 65th Annual Meeting of the American Epilepsy Society. Dr. Metter, your study confirms that valproate's negative effects on children's IQ persist from age 3 to age 6. Why do you think valproate exposure has a negative effect on children's IQ?
The best theory that we have about that is that there's an effect of some drugs on the immature brain, similar to alcohol. When a immature brain, a fetal brain, is exposed to alcohol, in the third trimester especially, there can be an increased death of cells, apoptosis. There's a normal apoptosis that occurs at that time, but this is an accelerated apoptosis. And more severe than that, it leaves the remaining neurons dysfunctional in terms of their plasticity. And so their ability to respond during neurodevelopment is impaired. Because there's some of the receptors that are affected by alcohol overlap with some anticonvulsant drugs, people raised the idea about whether this might happen with anticonvulsant drugs too. And in fact, there's been several labs testing different anticonvulsant drugs. And they can do this. Some of them can, like phenobarbital and benzodiazepines and valproate. Some of the drugs don't do it. At least in monotherapy, they may, when they're mixed with another drug, enhance its ability to do this. The reason I think valproate is probably the worst player in this regard is when you look at the animal studies, the relative blood levels achieved by valproate in relationship to the therapeutic range that we use to treat humans, the effect of apoptosis occurs at a lower level than other drugs that do produce this effect. In fact, the effects occur at a level that's even below what we would think kind of the therapeutic range is for valproate.
Now, as you mentioned, your study compared valproate with carbamazepine, lamotrigine, and phenytoin. Did fetal exposure to any of these latter drugs affect children's IQ?
Well, one limitation in our study is that we didn't have a control group. We wanted to have a control group, and the original NIH review panel recommended we take the control group out. We were not able to have a control group. There have been other studies with control groups with lamotrigine and carbamazepine that have not shown differences to the control groups. In our study, we found no difference between carbamazepine, lamotrigine, and phenytoin, and the big difference was valproate being much worse than those three drugs. So not necessarily from our study, but from these other studies, I think that probably these other three drugs are not producing effects different than children not exposed.
I see. So your findings essentially replicated those of the earlier study, but you did not have a control group.
Yeah, they're not actually earlier. They started after we began our study, and some of that data was published during the time that we were doing our study. I can talk more about that later.
Okay. Now, you found that the risk of low IQ depended on the dose of valproate, but you found no dose-dependent effects of the other AEDs. How do you interpret these results?
We think the effects are a type of teratogenicity, meaning there's a drug effect on the growing fetus. And you get most people, when they hear teratogenic effects, they think of malformation. So that's structural teratogenicity. I think this is kind of behavioral teratogenicity. But any teratogen should typically act in a dose-dependent manner. So as the dose gets higher and higher, the exposure higher and higher, the risk goes higher and higher. It acts on a genetic base, and so there's some people be less susceptible than others, and that's why we see variance. Across children exposed to the same dose from their mother, we will see this variance occur. We didn't see dose-dependent effects of the other drugs. There may be several reasons why we didn't. First, maybe the risks that they impose are much smaller, or maybe they don't even have a risk in this regard. I suspect that if we got the dose high enough, it would, but our dose range may be such that it doesn't have enough. They can get up to enough higher ranges to really produce any effect on these other drugs. In regards to malformations, at first they were not finding dose-dependent effects for some of the drugs like carbamazepine and lamotrigine, but recently this summer, a very large study from Europe looked at dose-dependent effects and found it really for all the four major drugs that they had the most pregnancies for, which were carbamazepine, lamotrigine, phenobarb, and valproate. And so I'm not completely sure that if you got the dosages really high, whether that might produce an effect with these other drugs. It did not do it in monotherapy within the range tested in animals, so it's likely that maybe these drugs, we didn't see a dose-dependent effect because they don't have an effect. Mm-hmm. Another confounding factor may be that clearance changes during pregnancy, so the drug is eliminated faster, and they may not, the dose may not represent the exact exposure. And unfortunately, there's no studies on malformations or cognition in humans that have systematically followed the mother's blood level and assessed that as part of the evaluation to see if the blood level, which is closer to what the child's getting exposed to, a closer marker of that, whether that would have a blood level effect or not. That has not been done for either malformations or for cognitive effects in these situations.
Mm-hmm. Now, also in your study, as measured by the differential ability scale, verbal cluster score was lower than nonverbal cluster score for valproate and lamotrigine, but not for phenytoin and carbamazepine. And why do you think that is?
This was, we first saw this when we did a secondary analysis of the 3-year-old data. And we were surprised by it to some degree. But when I look back at the literature, when we look at the older studies of valproate, they actually didn't show a full-scale IQ effect. They showed a verbal IQ effect. So they were suggesting that maybe the effect of the valproate was more on verbal than nonverbal. And so we saw that at 3 years of age for valproate. We saw it at 6 years of age for valproate. We saw at 4.5, or I'm sorry, at 3 years of age, we saw an effect for carbamazepine, but that went away, and now at 6, we see an effect for lamotrigine. So I'm less sure about the effects on other drugs. I think it's pretty clear that valproate must, its effect on the brain has a bigger effect on language skills than it does non-language skills. Although in our study, we found that valproate affected a whole host of different cognitive domains at 6 years of age. Now, you might raise the question, why would verbal abilities be more susceptible to the drug exposure than nonverbal? Mm-hmm. And it's not completely clear. It may be it's organized differently. It may be that the drug somehow affecting normal cerebralization, and cerebralization of functions is particularly important for language skills, where they typically become, our left brain becomes dominant for language skills. And if that normalization is disrupted by the drug exposure, maybe that's why the language skills are more affected. But we don't really know at this point. All we have is that we have our observations, the observations of two other studies showing that it appears that the language skills are particularly susceptible for to valproate exposure.
Valproate is one of the older AEDs, but have concerns about its effects on IQ been raised before?
Yes, they have. It was not before really about the time that we began our study over 10 years ago, but subsequently there was a study, a retrospective study published in England that is saw this effect on verbal IQ. In fact, their first publication, they just looked at incidence of need for special education across their population of patients in their large epilepsy population, and they found that more kids were needing special education assistance that were exposed to valproate. And then they went on to do formal testing and or to get the results that had been collected to formal testing, and they put those results together and looked and saw that the verbal IQ of the children exposed to valproate was worse than that of other children and to a non-exposed group. That study was somewhat limited because it's retrospective, and if you don't do it prospectively, you can't collect all the important data that may be confounding factors. There was one small prospective study. The number of kids on monotherapy was quite small, about 17. It was published about the same time in 2004 that from Finland that showed an effect again on verbal IQ. That study also had a very large cohort of kids on carbamazepine and didn't see any difference between the carbamazepine kids' IQ and those of a healthy control group. So those were the two prior studies looking at this. And then with our study, this became more obvious that there was a real risk here with valproate. And in fact, in 2011, the FDA added a warning about cognitive risk to the valproate labeling here in the U.S. primarily on our studies, but also supported by these other studies.
And in what year did the two previous studies appear?
They were published in 2004, and then we published our New England Journal article in 2009 for the three-year-old results. And then at the AES this year, we were presenting our six-year-old results,
right,
which we thought were very important. We wanted to see if there had been improvement 3 to 6, could the kids outgrow the effect? And while we did see across all the drugs some improvement across age, we don't know how much of that is practice effects versus maybe they're rebounding from other problems. But that difference, the relative difference between the drugs didn't change. Valproate still remained lower in overall IQ compared to the other drugs by about 8 points.
What would you say the clinical implications of your study are for the practicing neurologist?
I think the message is that this is not a good drug of choice for women of childbearing age. It's certainly not a first-line drug for that group. The problem is a subset of women with type of primary generalized epilepsy for which they will not respond to the other drugs. They're just going to respond to valproate. My approach is if I get a child exposed and they get a malformation or cognitive deficits, I can't fix that. But if I choose the wrong drug or one that doesn't work, I can fix that by changing the drug. So I usually would start and try several other drugs before I work my way to valproate. Then if we have to use valproate, I try to use it in a low dose and spread out the dose because that reduces the risk if you can do that. By low dose, though, I'm talking about a dose to produce a blood level around 40, 45, something like that. Probably lower the risk there. When you take the blood levels up higher, when you take dosages typically over 1,000, the risk starts to escalate. And so those kids are really at very, very high risk. In the real-world practice, you don't always have this choice. All these things should be done when the woman's first getting put on the drugs or you're first prescribing the drugs. And sometimes, because I run a pregnancy epilepsy clinic, the woman will come to me already on the drug and already pregnant. And so that's a more difficult situation. Or the woman comes down pregnant but has failed mother several drugs or only been on that drug and afraid to try the drug. So you have to do it on an individual basis with the woman to help make the best decision for her. But in general, it's not a drug that I certainly would use not as first line. It's a drug that I use as backup, but I have used it in women with epilepsy. I have taken women through pregnancy on valproate, and some of them have done quite well.
Well, thank you for your time, Dr. Metter. This is Eric Greb, Senior Associate Editor of Neurology Reviews. Thank you for listening.